Welcome to the 21st episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney and I'm your host. I'm a cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. I've started this podcast to try to bring awareness and educate people on the benefits of a plant-based diet. I've also like to bring on some endurance athlete and coaches from time to time to hear their stories and suggestions and hopefully learn from them as well. The last talk we featured Howard Jacobson, who was an educator and gardener and entrepreneur. He was also the co-author of Whole with T. Colin Campbell. On that podcast, we talked about some of his gardening in the backyard and, you know, how we kind of lose track of where our food comes from. Over the last couple of years, I've had some plants and herbs on my back porch, but after speaking with him, I decided to take that maybe to a little bit higher level. So I've planted some more greens, got some more seeds, maybe put some more planters in. So I'm hoping to get a little garden going in my backyard here in sunny Southwest Florida. So it was good fun trying to get things prepped a little this weekend, and we'll see how it goes. It gets awful hot here in the summer, but we'll see what we can grow, and it should be good fun. I've also signed up for a couple more events. I have a half marathon coming up in April that's local, and then we hope to do the inaugural Morgantown Marathon in the fall, and then we're signed up, of course, for the Beach to Battleship Ironman, and then I guess now we're going to think about doing Marine Corps Marathon again. So it's one of my favorite marathon races, should have a busy fall, so it'll give us something to train hard for this summer, knowing that we have so many events coming up. A couple episodes ago, I also interviewed Matt Fitzgerald, and we talked about the 80-20 plan, so I'm trying to be a little bit more conscious during my training, keeping the easy episodes easy and the harder episodes a little bit more zone 3 and 4, and we'll see how that goes. I hope to increase my volume for these events a little bit more than I have in the past and hopefully stay healthy through all of them. As far as my practice goes, you know, the office wellness class has been going well. This podcast is going well. I would like to increase the wellness and nutrition aspect in my office. I'm hoping to launch some more intensive private session education programs with, you know, hours of nutrition science and then menu planning and possibly going grocery shopping with individuals to try to educate them on getting the groceries for their menus and along with the menu planning and label reading. So I hope that, you know, since we're a snowbird or a vacation spot here in Florida, that, you know, maybe people interested in learning about plant-based nutrition would come and spend a day, a weekend, and spend at least half their time learning about plant-based nutrition. So more information on how to get in touch with me will be forthcoming in the next few episodes. Tonight, I have Dr. Thomas Campbell as a guest. Thomas Campbell is the son of T. Colin Campbell. He'll tell us his story, but basically he helped his father write the China Study and then became very much interested in medicine, even though he wasn't really on that career path to start with. He's now a family practice doctor in Rochester, New York, on faculty there where he did his residency program. And he brings up some interesting thoughts on being a family practice physician and how he incorporates wellness into his practice and the trials and tribulations of being the son of a controversial writer of the China Study and how he's dealt with that over the years. He's also now the director of the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies, which will be launching a lot more educational things. I would encourage all of you to check that website out. Also, you know, if you haven't read The China Study or Whole, that's, you know, another, those are two books that are must reads. there's also going to be some more documentaries come out, so that's a good website to kind of keep up to date on things. So without further ado, let's jump into the interview with Dr. Thomas Campbell. Welcome, Dr. Tom Campbell. You have a new book coming out, The Campbell Plan. You're the son of the infamous Dr. T. Colin Campbell that I've talked about so much and actually had on this podcast. So welcome. And, you know, tell me your story of becoming plant-based and being a plant-based physician and educator.
Well, it started back around the year 2000. So not too terribly long ago, but I was not interested in health or medicine or anything, nutrition at all. But my dad asked if I wanted to help him write a book for the public about his life's work. And so I moved back home. We thought it would take a year, and it ended up taking almost 4 years full time. And I really got much, much more into the research and the writing and the ideas, you know, into the library, much more so than I suspected at the outset. And I really developed a passion for it. And of course, at the end, we had written the China study, and that was published in 2005. And so after that, instilling a little bit of passion for the idea, and it having taken longer and me being a little bit older rather, you know, to move to another place again, I decided to go into medicine. And so I went after that into medical school and family medicine residency after medical school, because I think in some ways primary care is a great place to try to catch people with behavior change and nutrition before they end up in the hospital with a heart attack. And I finished my residency, and I've been practicing in a very traditional sort of standard family medicine university practice in Rochester, New York for the past year and a half, almost 2 years.
So you went back to medical school knowing full well the results of the China study, and I heard you interviewed on another podcast, and basically, you know, it was a gradual transition for you and your family, just like, and I actually talked to I had the pleasure of speaking with Leanne a couple of weeks ago. You know, it's a gradual transition. She said, you know, certain things started to disappear from the dinner, and, you know, you went on as the data came in. And so when you got into medical school, you know, did it come up? I mean, I know we get very little nutrition education, but there certainly had to be times when you were eating with your friends and or the parties or, you know, the some of the physiology lectures. And, you know, did the China study come up during your education as far as, hey, you know what my dad did, or you know what we did here, or have you heard about this?
You know, actually, I remained fairly anonymous through medical school, and that was because of my own interest in doing so, and also because not many people, interestingly, had really heard of the China study. I mean, it was generally a younger crowd of people who had not had the time or interest to read popular books on nutrition. So it wasn't really well known, and I kind of put my head down and just did the work. And there were opportunities when nutrition came up, and you know, did have a little bit of teaching on nutrition, but it was so superficial. And I found, as I still do, that when you don't really have time to engage a person, and that person has an open mind. Okay, so there's two parts. The person has to have a somewhat open mind, and you have to have a little bit of time. If you don't have those things, it's very, very difficult to impress upon them the benefits of a plant-based diet in any sort of convincing way. So especially medical students who they're kind of riding high, you know, they're at the top of their class, and they want to, sort of know everything and to suggest that something is wrong with the system, and that it's something as simple as eating more Brussels sprouts and broccoli. It didn't get me too far in most of my conversations, so I kind of left it quiet. You know, there's one story I always tell in medical school that was so frustrating. We had a small group discussion, so it's sort of a case-based learning thing, and we go over a case and discuss the patient and the evidence and all this stuff. And there was a case-based small group discussion on heart disease, and the facilitator is a cardiologist. You know, one of the questions was, is there any evidence that diet is related to heart disease? And one of my classmates said, you know, as soon as the question came up, just started laughing and snickering. And he was actually presenting the case. And he said, no, there's not really any evidence. And this, after writing the China study and all that, you know, it's just atrociously bad misinformation. And the cardiologist kind of said, well, you know, there's a little bit, there's some about Mediterranean diets, you know, this really extremely soft sell on possibility that the Mediterranean diet may have some benefit. And I had to, you know, a different person may have handled it differently, but I kind of kept my mouth shut and kind of vented to some other people, you know, in the computer lab afterwards, because it just was, you know, it's a very, very, very difficult environment. It's quite hostile in some ways, and particularly to superficial conversations of plant-based diets.
Yeah, you know, I mean, in my practice, I don't remember ever during my cardiology fellowship hearing anything about, you know, nutrition or dietary modification. I mean, you know, low salt for heart failure patients, and obviously don't smoke and eat low fat. And that was about how, you know, don't eat eggs perhaps. And that was about how far it went. And then, you know, like you, when I finally got into private practice and doing some reading, you know, we start pushing the Mediterranean diet a little bit, you know, so it made sense not to eat, you know, meat and lower your, you know, fat intake. And then I read Dean Ornish's book, and kind of after I went plant-based myself, and I was afraid to present it to patients because I thought, oh, they're going to, you know, this is such a radical concept, you know, to not add any oil. And I had the book, I gave the book to a few people and said, you know, if you can do this, this will help you. But, you know, there's good data here that says it reverses heart disease, but I, good luck pulling this off, you know, or having your, you know, taking this home for your wife to cook. And of course, people will look brand new, some of their, you know, and it's like, oh my, I can't do that, you know. And then kind of came full circle, you know, reading your dad's book, and then Forks Over Knives. I think that's where it kind of hit, you know, that it's such a, there's such possibilities of reversing disease. But I found that interesting, you know, listen to you talk. I thought, man, that must have been hard to sit through some medical school and, you know, just to be quiet or to go through. So you finished your residency, and are you at the university where you went to, did your fellowship now, or did you go to a different place?
Yeah, so I'm at the University of Rochester where I did my family medicine residency.
You've been, so people must know by now that you're associated with the China study. When did you come out of the closet, Tom?
my residency program actually was very supportive. That's one of the reasons why I chose to go there. It's they actually gave me the opportunity to present grand rounds with my father a couple times at our hospital about nutrition and diet and health and the work that we had done. And I got a chance to present to my fellow residents, and I had a little bit of extra time. Not really. I had just in my very brief spare time. They were very supportive of me doing things like writing articles or writing other things for other projects and recognizing me for that. So they were very supportive, and it was through that process when I became a little bit more sort of integrating that, you know, that side of my interest into medicine. That's sort of, you know, and then, it's gone quite well. My personal style is not to beat anybody over the head, but to, sort of see if there's an opening to people discussing it. and if they're interested in giving them more information, and people can do with it what they want. From the very beginning, I've never been particularly interested, actually, in trying to force people to eat a certain way. I mean, that just doesn't work. It's not very interesting. What's interesting to me is having somebody in their own head, sort of the light goes off in their head, and they get their own motivation to pursue a healthier diet and a healthier life for their own reasons. And you know, if they want to go there, that's great. And if they don't want to go there, we as human beings oftentimes don't have that power to force them to go to that place. So, you know, it's kind of a gentle but assertive sell.
Well, to give me an example, so I'll give you the traditional. So, a 48-year-old guy comes into your office and, you know, he's 40 pounds overweight. He's on a blood pressure pill. His sugar's creeping up to about 115. Looks like he might have some sleep apnea. And so his blood pressure is, say, 160. And he is a Applebee's chili-eating kind of guy that likes to go to football games and baseball games. Would you even bring nutrition up with him in that first visit?
You know, in the first visit, I might do more of an assessment of where he is with nutrition, because so often when I ask people that, you know, in a primary care office, when there's not any immense teaching moment. You know, in a primary care office, it's more about building a relationship rather than seizing the teaching moment opportunity most of the time, not always, but most of the time. And so the first visit, I might assess what their understanding of nutrition is. I might do a very superficial sort of 24-hour food recall. Sometimes I'll ask people, what did you have for breakfast this morning before you came in? What did you have for dinner last night? What did you have for lunch? What did you have any snacks? What have you been drinking? And then I might just ask, you know, what are you interested in nutrition? Even before I do the food recall, are you interested in nutrition? Have you been trying to do anything with nutrition? What have you been trying to do? And just see where they're coming from. Most of the time, they're coming from places that are just polar opposite. You know, most people have tried perhaps a low carb diet and didn't really work. Maybe they lost some weight for a little while, put it back on. That's very common. And other people are just doing sort of this very vague, this moderate sort of very vague, oh, I'm eating more salads kind of thing. And then if someone, depending on how they react to that initial kind of assessment, I might say to them in that first visit, I might say, you know, my particular interest is in nutrition. If I have a specialty, that's it. And I want you to know that nutrition is a way out of all these problems. And, you know, if you're interested, and I might give them my little 60-second spiel about the type of nutrition and diet I'm talking about. And then I give them some resources, and I say, you know, this may sound totally crazy, something you've never heard before, but I'd like for you to do a little bit of homework for me. Go watch Forks Over Knives or read this or that book, whatever applies to their situation. And, you know, see where it goes. Oftentimes in that setting, in the structure of a office visit, I don't have a very high success rate after one encounter. But certainly, you know, those people who are a little bit open, you know, over time, I think I have had many people who do make changes and start to reverse their illnesses, lose weight, you know, come off their medications. So not necessarily majority. I work with a tough population, but there's enough people that keep me going at it.
Yeah, the couple that you get keep you motivated. You know, personally, I think you're I can't help myself. Sometimes I even go in thinking that I'm going to, you know, be laid back and not approach it, but it's hard for me not to. And you know, you can look at people and you can also see their spouse. And some people really give you the, you know, you change the subject because it's, you're really barking up a bad tree, you know, and you can just feel the tension rising in the room and you kind of let it go. But You know, so what's your philosophy with, you know, knowing what you know with the China study, you know, the cancer patients that come in or cancer prevention in your office, you know, turn the table to, you know, a 45-year-old woman that's overweight and that's, you know, is, or maybe she's, maybe they've had breast cancer and a lumpectomy and they're still overweight. Any nutritional approach to them? Same way? Assess the situation?
Same thing. With cancer, depending on the type of cancer, I'm a little bit more cautious because the evidence is not as robust, certainly as it is with metabolic disease and heart disease. But, you know, there's lots of fantastic research to believe that nutrition has a great deal with prevention of cancer in the first place and also with prevention of recurrence. Secondary prevention. So I do tell people that, you know, nutrition is likely to be very, very important and invite them to have a conversation with me and if they're willing to do that. And a lot of times they are, but not always. You know, I do give most people at least the spiel about the you know, what I think is to be the healthiest diet, and mention a couple of research projects like prostate cancer, for example, and Dean Ornish. And I see a fair number of men because my partners are female, so I tend to see their husbands. So, you know, I talk about prostate cancer and PSA levels and some of the Dean Ornish research, and then in the context of overall diet. You know, I don't lay all of this on people. Obviously, the first time I see them, it's a little bit of a journey that you start out and then go a bit slowly, and then sometimes you kind of see how they respond. You see them next time, you pull back a little bit, don't talk about it, and then you next time maybe you push again. You know, I don't claim any fantastic mastery of this. Of this topic, for sure, because I think what really is hampering is the structure of a traditional medical visit. You know, you just don't have enough time to share with people the information when you're dealing with four different problems, and you know, have to do a lot of the traditional medical stuff as well. And then, oh, by the way, you know, overhaul your diet. It's pretty tough. So it's kind of a gradual process.
It's kind of sad, though, too, because most of the things that you have to deal with are basically lifestyle diseases and nutritional problems. So, you know, you can't actually get to the meat of it because, you know, I shouldn't say the meat of it, but you can't get to the heart of the situation because, like you say, you're putting out fires. And by the time, you know, it's like, well, okay, you don't get a chance to talk about the cause of a fire. And certainly, you know, being in a university practice, I did academic medicine for 3 years before going into private practice. And
yeah,
it's a little bit of a different beast. I feel sorry for the primary care people that, you know, are in these huge practices that have administrators over them to see 40, 50 patients a day. I mean, there's little hope that they can ever bring up nutrition.
No, that's right. That's right. I have the luxury of 20-minute follow-up visits and 40-minute new patient visits, and that's enough time to bring up nutrition now and then. You know, primary care docs who are out there doing 10-minute visits or 10 to 15-minute visits, you know, forget it with all the other stuff you have to deal with.
So tell me about the Campbell Plan, the book that's going to be released beginning of next month?
The end of next month. It's actually... Okay. Gosh, just about a month from now, March 24th. It's intended to be the follow-up book to the China study, the sort of the how-to companion guide. You know, 10 years after the fact, it basically lays out the specifics of the diet. In the China study, we had about 4 pages that were devoted to the diet, specifics of the diet, and it was still quite obviously 4 pages, very vague. And the Campbell Plan is really a book to flesh out that that outline. We have a chart in the China studies to flesh out that chart and talk about what is the optimal diet and talk about what are the hot topics sort of the most common questions I've heard over the years. The things that come up over and over and over, the questions about soy and phytoestrogens, the questions about gluten, the questions about fish and fats, and, you know, I thought, well, olive oil was healthy, those types of things. And then a very specific prescriptive two-week plan that with recipes for every meal every day, so people can try out some of the food. Now, what I've done with the menus and recipes is actually I never really understood people using a diet book as a cookbook. So what I decided to do was use the diet book I wrote as a more of a reference, and I've gotten about six or seven of my favorite cookbooks, approached the authors, and asked if I could share some of their recipes in my book. So people can use my book as a little cookbook, or they can use it as a reference to, cookbooks, real cookbooks that are full of fantastically healthy, tasty food. So, it's a little bit of science, but mixed in with a very practical approach.
Great. And I certainly look forward to that release. And so in your practice, you do some wellness sessions, or you have them available through the university, puts on, or how do those work?
Well, haven't started that yet in my practice, but we do hope to start a formal program soon. I have been doing on the side a couple sessions with my wife. My wife is also a physician. She's a specialist in preventive care with some training in pediatrics. And we've been doing, just to get out and do something different, we've been doing something called Lunch with Docs. And we've met just a few times here, and we've kept it very quiet, just my own patients and some family members and friends that they have, and basically meet on a Saturday. It's all volunteer. We put up all the resources for it, my wife and I, and we actually cook a meal and serve a meal for folks and have a discussion, a little brief lecture, talk about some scientific topic, and then eat lunch and talk about, what's in the food and people's questions about this food. Probably the most important part of the session is the food, because people have tasty lasagna, and that's more convincing than 30 minutes of me blabbing away about some research study.
Yeah, the first thing I always hear when I start this, my diatribe on plant-based nutrition is, oh, you mean if it tastes good, don't eat it? And it's like, well, no, it's like I actually look forward to my meals at the evening. So I try to quick spout off, what I've had or I'm going to have for dinner or lunch the next couple of days. And that kind of, it's like, oh, that doesn't sound so bad. And, so I can kind of snafu people in that way, yes. But I think so many people are, well, in my population, because there's a lot of retired people down here, one, they like to go out to eat. So where would they possibly go out to eat, which is very limited? And two, will their friends abandon them if they actually would adopt a diet like this?
Right.
And, so that those are really big hurdles. That and the spouse, I don't know if you have issues with, so. And I guess it comes from the more I think about it, one partner may have tried various nutrition ideas over the years. And so coming home and saying we're going to be plant-based is just another in the, cog in the different diet themes of the year or the new year or whatever. So spouses are often reluctant, and that's a huge problem, whether they're the spouse is the cook or they're the cook and cooking two meals and, not really wanting to cook one meal, let alone two meals. So where do you find situations like that as well?
Yeah, it's the social support is so crucial in determining what we do or what behaviors we change. And I don't know if this is true, but I have this sort of vague perception that I think spouses are less likely to accompany the patient at primary care visits compared to specialist visits. So there's lots of times when I just see the patient without a spouse. That's the norm. And so I don't, I always encourage them. I say, you know, bring your, particularly if I find out that it's, you know, the spouse or the wife or the husband who does the cooking and not the patient, I say, you know, next time you come in, please feel free to bring your partner. I have had, you know, an occasion or two, I've had it go both ways. Sometimes the spouse is the health promoter and they are going to be my greatest ally. And I've had, another experiences where the spouse is looking at me like, you know, my God, you're just another one of these food quacks. I have, you know, we will never, ever do this. He's never going to do this. She's never going to do this. Forget it. You know, and I can only imagine, you know, what they're saying after the visit. It's important to get the spouse. It's not something that I've been able to control.
And speaking of quacks, it's I think it's, you know, in the physician community too, it's a kind of a fine line you have to walk. I don't know how many, you know, besides your wife, are there any other family practice people that are plant-based? And, you know, at what point do you become more of the extreme alternative guy, you know, even though there's an MD by your name?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I live a little bit of a double life. You know, I can push it pretty hard with patients sometimes, but with my colleagues, I let it be because of that same issue. You know, you have sort of a health expert who's counseling patients all day, giving patients answers. And if they're not particularly greatly interested and you have 30 seconds to interact, you're not going to change. You know, you're just going to create some friction if you really push things. Everyone knows about my interests, but it's something that I sort of do on my own. And again, I have a very supportive group. I have great respect for my colleagues and the people I work with, my partners and my hospital system. I'm getting great opportunities to pursue this type of work and support to do so. Another grand rounds here coming up soon. So I am getting out there, but it's something that is not defining my identity by any stretch. I think I define myself as a traditional family medicine doctor. I don't consider myself to be an alternative practitioner. And, you know, when indicated, I certainly follow the guidelines and the drugs and procedures and referrals. I don't do crazy, wacky, alternative medical things. I just happen to supplement it also with nutrition. And so I think people understand that and they appreciate it, but I don't beat anyone over the, you know, my colleagues, I have no agenda with them and their, whatever they think of me. I just leave that to, the chips will fall where they may.
Any research projects going on?
Not currently, no. I'd love to get into some and hopefully will soon. I'm working out, hopefully some opportunities that I'm not really quite cemented, so I can't discuss publicly, but I'm trying to, I'm getting there. Mm-hmm. I'll just say that. I'm getting there.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's it's a difficult plank to walk.
Yeah.
Knowing that something very simple can help people and trying to get the message across in a timely fashion.
Yeah. One of the things that I found sticks in my head was when I think about I do this little morning news thing on occasion up here, sort of as a representative of the university, and I did a segment on tobacco, and there is some recent news this past fall from the CDC that this prevalence of tobacco smoking is at the lowest it's ever been since the recording, which is great news, of course. But one of the things that I think is so interesting about that is that there's a critical mass where for smoking, I think it's become abnormal in most social groups, in most social levels. It's become abnormal to smoke. And when your friends aren't doing it and when there's no place to do it, you know, you have to walk two blocks to go have a cigarette, especially in Rochester, New York, that social aspect is so powerful. It's so powerful that it can. It's reached sort of a. It's almost moving on its own. It's got its own engine up and running, the smoking cessation thing at this point, where it's going to continue becoming more and more abnormal, and that's going to drive public activity. And when I think about that, and then I think about nutrition, you know, we're working against the opposite. We're still at such an early stage where it's people are just gorging themselves on animal foods and processed foods, a lot of people, and eating hardly any fruits and vegetables. And that's the social norm, you know. But as we move forward and start to change social norms, it's going to be sort of a mindless, you know, the goal is to make this sort of a mindless transition where people just happen to be doing this more and more. And I think that's kind of, it strikes me as an interesting model that can apply to nutrition. And I think it's something that, I think we'll get there, but we're way behind the curve. We're at the beginning still.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I think it came about by social policy. For the most part, you can't smoke inside, the Surgeon General warnings, various things. And, you know, up until, you know, currently, we still have a huge pushback from dairy and meat lobbyists as far as getting any of those things changed, you know, all the way down to this, you know, the school lunch programs and things like that. But yeah, I think I agree. If, you know, if your friends do it, it's pretty cool. But and it really amazed me, you know, again, that the older population, that social, if your friends do it, it's okay. And if they don't, it's not, is very important. And you know, it's just getting the social support. We've started a meetup group here in town, where, you know, it's called the Charlotte County Plant-Based Foodies. And so once a month, the group meets. Sometimes we go out to dinner and have a chef prepare, you know, a plant-based, no added oil type meal. Sometimes it's just talking about, you know, various, do a book club or just having a question and answer, or, you know, going around the room and, you know, different discussions. And, you know, that support, I think, is huge for people trying to, you know, change their lifestyle. And it's very interesting. I think more and more people, you know, are curious. And, yeah, probably, you know, 50% of the people that come are curious people. They have not made the change, but they are curious. And friends, there's a couple people that they'll bring five or six people from their church, you know, and, you know, I guess in some respects, you know, there's certainly people that want to help people, but I think also they're trying to get their social circles so that, you know, okay, if we all do this, it'll be cool, you know, as opposed to just me.
Right.
So I think, you know, that plays a huge role in things.
Yeah.
But it is hard to change people, you know, after they're so indoctrinated all over, you know, throughout their years. So it's interesting. And, you know, I've spoken with you, you know, Dr. McDougall kind of runs a different kind of practice. Dr. Esselstyn kind of runs a different practice. Those people come to them already wanting this and just needing help. I think there's another cardiologist, Dr. Kahn, which I've heard him interviewed, that, you know, I hope to get him on. I think he suffers from sort of the same plight that maybe you and I do, as far as people don't really come wanting to hear about nutrition. They come with problems, and they want the problems fixed so they can go back to their other social, you know, whatever they need to do in life. So it's difficult. I look, you know, I think the more and more resources we have, I look forward to getting your book in the office, and you know, just more positive information. I think the better.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And it's about creating a little bit of a social support system for folks. I totally agree.
So yeah, anything on the? I guess you're are you involved? You have a brother that's a physician as well, right?
I don't. I'm the only one in my family.
Oh, you're the only one. Okay. I know there's another documentary coming out. Were you a part of that as well, or no?
I wasn't. No, I was in residency when he was doing most of that, so it was not very conducive to getting out. But he's got, I guess my understanding is that some of the team from the folks who did Forks Over Knives to do a documentary called Plant Pure Nation, and that's coming out soon, too, actually. They're starting their tour, I believe, in April, and then they'll have a sort of more open release a little bit later, sort of at the beginning of the summer, if I'm not mistaken. But, yeah, it looks very good. The trailer is up online.
Very cool. Have you had people come into your office and have put you two together from the get-go, or is it usually that not too many people come in knowing about the China study?
Some people, the word's gotten out a little bit. Some people have come in knowing about my interests. I have on my profile page, I think, with the university practice, I can't remember what I wrote, but it's something, I think I mentioned something about nutrition and maybe even mentioned the China study, I'm not sure. So some people know, or they know I just am interested in nutrition without really knowing what kind of nutrition I'm about to tell them about. But I've had enough people in the community. You know, Rochester's got, gosh, I don't know, a million people roughly in the greater Rochester area. So it's not tiny. There's certainly a big plant-based community here. And a fair number of them have now sought me out. It's been enough time. But the vast majority of people don't know really anything about my background or interest in nutrition.
What role do you think, I mean, in the ideal world, would you like nutrition to play a larger role in your practice?
Yeah, I do, and that's what we're working on now, creating a whole new sort of clinical program. But basically, I think where I stumble is that, you know, there's no... I'm not able to provide people with any skills or even talk about any skills. You know, a lot of people don't know the first thing about cooking. I'm not able to provide any social, relatedness. One of the things when I was writing my book, I was very interested in behavior change and incorporating some behavior change lessons in that. And one of the theories that I like is called self-determination theory. And it suggests that there's three things that we need when we, make behavior change that make us more likely to be successful. One is autonomy, you know, being in control of your own actions. The other is relatedness, that is, the change is going to bring you closer to those important people in your life. And the other is competence, knowing that you have the skills to make this change. And when I see people in the office, I can help them with their autonomy. I mean, I can help them sort of come to their own decision and believe that it's the right thing to do to change their diet, but I can't do anything in an office visit that addresses their competence or their self-perception of competence or their sense of relatedness. You know, I can't provide a support group in the office setting, and I can't help them, you know, see what the food tastes like. I can't tell them how to shop or how to read a label with the amount of time I have. So ideally, I think nutrition has to be slightly separate from the traditional office visit. And, the United States Preventive Services Task Force just came out with a recommendation at the end of last summer. I think all overweight and obese people with risk factors for cardiac disease, you know, which of course is what? Two-thirds of the population?
Yes,
and
at least, yeah.
Probably more than that from the traditional patient population. They recommend all of those people should be referred to an intensive lifestyle program. Now, if you go around and ask doctors, you know, how many patients they've referred to intensive lifestyle programs, you're going to get probably some funny blank stares. And what we need to change that, though. We need to have intensive lifestyle programs that can address those other parts of behavior change and make it easy for people really support them in their change, and to have it be part of the medical system. So it would be, it wouldn't be some sort of wacky outside thing. When I say wacky, I say wacky in quotes. It wouldn't be, you know, because it couldn't be perceived as some sort of alternative, you know, camp. It has to be something that's within the system, within the academy, so to speak, that is side by side with traditional medical practice. And I think if we can get financial incentives, there's some hope that maybe financial incentives will be changing in some ways, that we can get that kind of model off the ground. But I think that's what needs to happen.
Yeah, those are some really good ideas. There's certainly a lot of work to be done, because I think that physicians ultimately need to bridge that gap. We have these people on all these medications, and somebody's got to get them off. And and it's not easy or, you know, necessarily safe to get them off, you know, just a cold turkey. And there's got to be some sort of, you know, some bridge and some physician input and physician, helping out in the, you know, it's kind of, I guess, a multi-tier approach to things. Until physicians start opening their eyes to, yeah, this is a problem, and maybe not fearing that this is, you know, Jesus, if I cure all these people, what will I do? or refer them all out for, you know, their competency training, what will I do? It's a complicated endeavor, kind of changing the way medicine, you know, traditionally has been practiced.
Right. Well, the sad truth is, as much as people, it's nice to say that it's easy to say, for whether you're a cardiologist or whoever you are, it's easy to say, you know, let's improve people's health so much that we're out of a job. You know, you can say that because there's absolutely no chance that that's going to happen, because there's so much illness and sickness that has befallen so many people in our society, and social norms are so opposite of what they should be with regard to promoting health that there's no, in my working career, I think there's almost no chance of actually getting people so healthy that they don't need an acute medical care system, or even a chronic disease, you know, a reactive chronic disease medical care system. So I think it's a blessing and a curse that I don't think that really, in terms of the financial system, I don't think that this is anytime soon going to present a large threat to anybody, you know, looking at the budgets. Hopefully that'll change, but it's not coming in the next couple of years.
No, I always tell people, as long as you can, we have, you know, the town, you drive up the main street, and it's fast food restaurant after fast food restaurant after fast food restaurant right after you leave the office. So, you know, I mean,
right.
You know, if I've got 40 minutes with them, you know, once every 4 months, then, or, you know, usually not that long, 20 minutes maybe every 4 months. But, you know, as soon as they leave, they're hungry and inundated with this stuff. It's very difficult. So there's a lot of work to be done, but it's very exciting. And, you know, I remain very hopeful that, you know, more and more physicians are getting on board. And, you know, if nothing else, we can provide a support network for each other and maybe get some real research, you know, get some real case studies, you know, and get some, you know, expand on some of Dr. Esselstyn's work and expand on some of Dr. Ornish's work. And
I've been really pleased with the physicians I've met. There's just, when we first started writing the China study just 10 years ago, and we wanted to talk to people about the medical community, you know, there were just a handful of people that we could even think about. And now, I'm also the executive director of the Center for Nutrition Studies. We do online education with eCornell. And now we have so many, I mean, I go to these conferences from time to time, and there are so many physicians, and I've just been thrilled with the number of practicing physicians who are interested in this and quite passionate about this, and particularly the cardiologists out there. I mean, I think that the depth of evidence for heart disease and diet has just reached a point where anybody who's really looking with an open mind, you cannot deny that nutrition, particularly plant-based nutrition, is an important part of heart disease. And so to see the cardiologists, and particularly with the respect that you and other cardiologists get by virtue of being cardiologists, it's just been very exciting, really phenomenal, wonderful to see. And it's really great. It's been a huge change just in 10 years, actually.
I did take the E. Cornell course, and it was actually one of the best continuing medical education courses I've ever taken. So, you know, I recommend it highly to anybody. It's a great course, and, you know, eye-opening and generous, and, it was fantastic. So, yeah, I am a frequent visitor to your site, and, you know, we'll continue to do your programs. Well, I won't take much more of your time up this Friday afternoon. I'm sure you need to probably go shovel snow or something in Rochester.
Yeah, well, if not now, it's probably tomorrow.
Okay, good. But thank you so much for taking time to speak with me, and I'll look forward to tracking the response to your book and getting the word out myself.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. All thanks right. so much for what you're doing, too.
All right, thank you. Have a good weekend.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hope you enjoyed that interview. A few takeaways: autonomy, relatedness, and competence. I hope that through this podcast, through our wellness classes in the office, and just with my office visits, I can help people come to the conclusion that they want to make the decision to go plant-based. I think it's very important for people to read as much as they can and make up their own mind. You know, I often give several books to read with the number of interviews that are on YouTube and some TED Talks. There's a lot of short videos that people can watch that, will lead you to investigate more if you have interest. Certainly anything by Dr. Campbell, Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, John McDougall, they're all great YouTube videos to check out to be able to make your own decision to go plant-based. I think that comes back to people in households that, come home and they want to be plant-based or try it, and their spouse is very leery. Again, educating yourself, doing education together, I think helps and maybe decreases the fear that this is not going to be some sort of a fad diet, but that everybody can benefit from it and that it's safe and it's healthy. The relatedness, again, the more support you have, the better it is. So certainly if you have the chance to go to a meetup or a wellness event and, you and your partner can both go, or a family member or friend, it certainly helps to have support and somebody to talk to. But, there's more and more people on social networks that are plant-based. There's a whole host of sites where you can get free recipes. There's a whole host of podcasts that you can listen to that address a lot of these difficult situations. So, you're not alone like people were 20 years ago that decided to go plant-based or vegan and had absolutely no clue. And, the competence to do so, I'd love to help you become more plant-based through the office, through the podcast, whatever I can do. Certainly, if you have questions, jamiedelaney@gmail.com, I'd love to hear them. I saw the movie American Sniper, and this is not plant-based, but it goes back to our healthcare system and how we're so ill-equipped to take care of our veterans when they come home from such awful things that they've experienced and witnessed, and the delay that it takes to get our veterans in to get psychiatric help or physical therapy or help them with the challenges from their wounds. Today, it was kind of brought home with to me, I had a patient that was what we call a VA patient. He got all his medical care at the VA, and in the town I live in, there's not a VA hospital, so they have to go, you know, an hour one way or another to get to a VA hospital, but there are VA clinics. He was wounded in Vietnam, shot a couple times, has been on disability, has been on Prozac for, I presume, depression most of his life. He's had coronary artery disease, he's overweight, he's diabetic, he has high blood pressure. And he was admitted for very high blood pressures and some side effects from that. He told me that the VA is following his carotid arteries because they're blocking up, but not one time in all his visits to any place has nutrition been discussed. And it just made me very sad to see this gentleman who served our country so bravely so many years ago that has just been a victim of a system that just drags people along but doesn't really change anything, and he's continued to get more sick over the years. So we sat and had a chat. I gave him some references, some books to try to read, some YouTube videos like we talked about above. But, you know, I felt really bad that this guy certainly didn't have the tools to become plant-based or to really change his diet at this time. So, you know, again, I just want to reach out to people that if there's a question that I can answer, you know, I would love to try to help people, especially in this situation. And, you know, maybe I need to think a little bit about extending some of my wellness programs into going down to the VA and maybe approaching them. I'm not sure. But it was certainly something for me to think about professionally. I hope you enjoy the interviews. I hope the weather is starting to get better wherever you are. I know there's still some really bad icy weather and flood conditions, so I hope you're staying safe. I hope you have plenty of vegetables on hand. If you have nothing to do but listen to some episodes of my podcast and you happen to like them, I'd love a five-star iTunes review. Again, if you have any questions, please contact me at jamiedelaney@gmail.com. Until the next time, stay plant-based and be strong.